Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Hello all, and welcome back to another Earth Observation-focused GeoMob Podcast episode. Today I'm talking with two people who work for Planet, one of the most well-known companies in the sector. Luisa, Maddie, welcome to GeoMob.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So maybe we can quickly get an idea of your background and how you ended up at Planet, maybe from each of you. And one of you, if you could give a quick overview of Planet for those listeners who don't know the organization, that would be really cool as well. So maybe, Maddie, we start with you.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Maddie. I'm a scientist focused on developing approaches to derive insights from Earth observation data. I originally started off in geography, but by the end of my degree was focusing more on Earth observation and GIS because I just enjoyed the combination of understanding physical and spatial relationships with data, and, you know, coding and working with satellites always sounded cool as well, particularly when I was like 18. And this all led me eventually to complete a PhD in approaches to identify changes in land cover in current and historic satellite data at Aberystwyth University in Wales. Really enjoyed the problem-solving aspect of research. So after my PhD, I kind of always stayed in research-type roles, typically around approaches to detect vegetation dynamics, characteristics, changes, that kind of thing, with a range of Earth observation data, optical, radar, LIDAR, aerial, satellite, kind of across the whole spectrum, which eventually brought me to Planet, kind of 2.5 years ago now, I think I joined Planet, and just kind of continue working in this vein to deliver insights from Planet data for customers.
That's very cool. I can totally relate because I went to university thinking I was going to become an Antarctic meteorologist or climatologist, and then someone showed me a land cover map and I was like, no way, satellites, want to do that.
Yeah. Cool. It always sounds cool to say you work in the space sector as well.
Yeah, exactly. And Luisa, maybe you could introduce yourself and maybe say a little bit about Planet.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Luisa. I am an environmental engineer that also stumbled upon GIS during my degree. I was a little bit frustrated that I've never seen it before. And then I was like, am I in the wrong degree? Should I switch? I kind of stuck with it because I'm really interested in generally environmental matters. But later on, I decided to specialize in remote sensing and GIS and starting to bring the two together. So I've been mostly focusing on helping organizations, individuals from governments to civil society, a lot of work there, but also private sector making use of all kinds of data. Before it was called the big data, and now we're just going to data for decision making. And I think I'm particularly versed in sustainability and environmental questions and how to tackle them. And really, I think satellite data is actually fantastic for this kind of problem setting and problem solving. And I guess that's what brought me to Planet as well. And I agree, it's really cool to say you work in the space sector, although most times when you mention that you work at Planet, everyone's just like, either they know it or it's a very confusing conversation. Yes. That ensues. It's like, Planet? Like, the Earth? Indeed. And now to explain what Planet is for the ones that may not know it. So we are a private company that works in the space sector. We design, build, operate our own satellites, and we also sell the data, of course, and all the derived data, like Maddie was saying, that she's working on building. Planet's unique value proposition, or one of the things that makes Planet quite innovative and different, is that we run CubeSats, and we have more than, I don't know exactly the number right now, because our constellation is always being replenished. So we have some hundreds of satellites continuously in space, and they do continuous collection of data, which is also not really typical. So we are a little bit of a paradigm shift in Earth observation, because we have so many images. Sometimes we have too many images. And typically when you work with satellite data, you work with one before, one after, or one every, I don't know, interval of time that you feel is relevant. And in Planet's case, you can have, there's even situations that you have more than once a day. Yeah. And the way you approach problems can really be different. It actually has opened up the possibility of data integration and types of data analysis that haven't really been typically done in this sector until now. And that can be both very interesting, like in a very fulfilling way, because you can do more and you can have better information. But it can also be very challenging because it's really asking people to not only work differently from a technology perspective, even from a math modeling perspective, but also from how do you frame the problem and what kind of questions you want to have answered and what kind of answers you're expecting. So it's a little bit of like, woof, everything goes up in the air and we have to kind of relearn how to do these things.
That's very cool. I mean, there are so many things we could talk about in terms of what Planet is and how they're reshaping the industry and all the different types of satellites that they have and everything else. And then there's both of your careers, which are obviously really interesting as well. But what I want to focus on is maybe the applications of the new satellite technology that Planet is making available. I think maybe if we can start with a blog post that Maddie wrote. Maddie, could you give us an outline of the article that you wrote? Because it was really interesting.
Yeah, sure. So this was a blog post on deriving growing degree days from Planet's land surface temperature product. So just to give a bit of background here, when it kind of comes to farming, keeping track of how crops are going is just super important. And one way of doing this is a concept called growing degree days, or GDD for short. So we kind of know generally that temperature is really important in influencing plant growth rates, and GDD provides us a quantitative way of tracking this. And basically by adding up the temperature above a certain point that plants need to grow through time, this can kind of help farmers figure out when crops should be hitting certain key growth stages like flowering, harvest, that kind of thing. Typically, calculations for this are based on data from a nearby weather station, stationary object. But satellite-derived land surface temperature could offer us a kind of more precise alternative here. Planet's land surface temperature, planetary variable, gives a global look at the Earth's surface temperature. It's updated twice a day, once in the night and once in the early afternoon, and works by pulling together data from multiple different types of satellite sensors that measure microwave radiation from the ground. This is then sharpened by some patented downscaling approaches and enhanced by Sentinel-2 to give us a final 100 meter per pixel measurement of land surface temperature, which allows us to capture temperature variation at a kind of much finer scale than individual weather stations, and can reveal differences in temperature across fields that we, individual fields that we kind of might miss with weather stations. Plus, while most weather stations measure air temperature, the LST, or land surface temperature, is directly measuring the thermal energy at the surface, which may be a kind of more accurate representation of the thermal energy available to our crops. So what the blog post focuses on and what we were kind of aiming to do was explore the relationship between LST and daily temperature extremes, GDD, and establish how it could be used to calculate this established metric. So to calculate growing degree days, you kind of need to know the maximum and the minimum, the high and the low points for the day to give an average. Now, the satellite data is collected at specific times during the day and night, which kind of relate to, but are not perfectly aligned with the true minimum and maximum temperatures. So to fix this, we basically modeled from the Planet LST product, the daily minimum and maximum. And then GDD is based on the amount over a crop-specific base temperature that this average temperature has been summed through time. So we then compared our Planet LST-derived GDD with data from traditional weather station sources and using crop records from specific fields in both Germany and the US, where we know what the growth stages were. We summed the GDD between these dates to compare variation across our fields. The reason for this being that the ground measured data indicates that a similar amount of thermal energy should have been impacted the field between those dates. So we would hope that our satellite and weather station metrics show the same thing. So we'd expect similar GDD values from across all of our different sources. And our results showed that the satellite-derived GDD was as consistent or more consistent across our sample fields, with a slightly lower standard deviation in total GDD. Across the US and Germany.
Cool. Okay, brilliant. Thank you for that. There's a couple of things I want to pull out of that. So you said crop-specific GDD. So if I had a field of potatoes and I had a field of barley, is there some index or something that I apply to the numbers that come out of that to make it apply to those crops?
Yeah, so the crop-specific bit basically comes from the temperature at which growth occurs over. So for most crops, this is about 10 degrees Celsius. Anything below that, the crop's not actually having enough energy to grow. It's just kind of in stasis, effectively. And so what we're measuring is anything over that threshold. This varies a little bit from crop to crop. So ideally, for the kind of best measure of GDD, we would know the crop to know which threshold to use. And these are established by various studies in literature.
If only you worked for a company that could do sort of daily crop maps or something. If only. So I know that LST and air temperature are related, but they're not exactly the same. And you have sort of mentioned a little bit in your summary about how you were dealing with this. But how are you accounting for the fact that you've got sort of effectively a thermal measurement from the surface itself and then another one from sort of a little bit a near surface air temperature, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, there is absolutely a difference between land and air temperature. You know, the land temperature will be much more affected by the absorption rate of the surface, if it's dark or light, that kind of thing. And the air temperature will be impacted by the humidity, because moist air will hold temperature better than dry air. There's also some differences in the rate at which land surface heats up and cools down compared to air temperature, that kind of thing. We accounted for this basically with the linear regression model, defined based on the relationship between the US climate reference network data and Planet's LST. Across 10 years worth of data, I think it was over 400,000 sample points. It's kind of possible to get different levels of complexity to describe this relationship. We found that, perhaps unsurprisingly, LST day temperature will explain the majority of max air temperature variation. But by adding in other features like length of day, number of days from solstice, we can kind of get a stronger relationship. And this is something that would be interesting to kind of explore further and experiment with a bit more features, things like climatic zone, the surface darkness, vegetation cover, that kind of thing could really help explain this a bit more. But I think that what we've done in the blog post provides a kind of good baseline as well. Any other approaches that are more complex or require significantly more features would ideally deliver a significant improvement kind of over what we've shown here. And our initial aim was to just set out to see if we could kind of establish a reasonable relationship and a reasonable measure of GDD. We weren't looking to shoot for this unnecessarily. But yeah, and kind of as a slight aside on this, I think it's also interesting to explore the concept of GDPD just from surface data without necessarily trying to relate to air temperature, especially for kind of early development phases where the crops haven't yet emerged and the surface temperature might actually better relate to growth and thermal energy for growth than the air temperature anyway.
Cool. I know that one of the things that people who are new to remote sensing or maybe don't know it quite as well as some people who've been around it for a while, they're always looking for higher and higher spatial resolutions. But is this one of those applications where 100 meters is perfectly adequate and there's no point getting even finer than that?
I mean, you can always argue for higher resolution, definitely. I mean, I will always take more data. But when it comes to kind of per field, it's one of those questions of how big is the field as well, and how much variation can we expect to see. Certainly, like one of our sites here is the US, the fields there are very large, 100 meters more than adequate to kind of get the field. A very small fields, you maybe want a higher resolution. And there's potentially some interesting things with kind of within field variation as well, where it'd be nice to get a bit more. But for this kind of individual field level study, 100 meters resolution is we found to be adequate anyway.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, it was a really, really interesting blog post, and thank you for writing it. We'll make sure that it's linked to in the show notes as well. Louisa, maybe I can move over to you now. And are you able to introduce us to something called Project Sentinella?
Yeah.
I think that's how you say it.
Yeah, Sentinella. I think it's a Latin American. There's a whole story behind the name. And I have to say my first reaction when I read the title was like, I think people will confuse it with Sentinel. But there's a very interesting story that I will not butcher, but I just want to summarize to say that it kind of tries to condense or concentrate this idea that a lot of species are going extinct in the world every single day. And then sometimes there are locations on Earth where a lot of those species that sometimes were thought to be extinct actually still survive and sometimes even thrive. And I think Sentinella refers to a specific mountain range in Latin America. I don't want to mislocate it in the many countries that are in Latin America. And that it's a location where some species were found and it's considered a very important biodiversity hotspot. So Project Sentinella is actually a program from Planet in the spirit of the PPC, so the Public Goods Corporation that Planet is. And it's an attempt to do good and to really bring Planet's data, all kinds of data, all kinds of insights and variables to the people that are working on the ground to really bring science and technology to try to conserve or potentially even restore some of the biodiversity of the planet. So Project Sentinella is aiming at covering or providing data over 50 of the world's hotspots of biodiversity. Okay. Yep. The idea is that they will be selected based not only on biodiversity, but also on risk. So it should be locations that in which action is actually relevant and can be impactful. And also with the spirit of having effective impact. So we really would like to have partners that come together and really represent not only the capability of using Earth observation data, but also the capability of taking action. So the knowledge coming together potentially from academia or technicians, but also either communities on the ground, local governments or governmental institutions that can then take the decision-making process forward and implement something.
Okay.
So it's a very cool project, and it was launched recently. And I think we have quite a few locations selected already, spread out around the world. That's also one of the goals, to have a good geographic representation. And I think we're receiving really interesting applications. And if someone is listening that would like to apply or know someone, I would really recommend you do that, because I think it's a great opportunity to really explore how this kind of data can help your work.
So you've mentioned that there's ways people can apply to be part of the project. And you also mentioned academia as possible partners. Inside Planet, do you get to sort of work on the project as a project, or is it more about data supply, or like,
that's a good question. Yeah, actually, at the moment, the idea is that Planet is acting more as a data supplier of data. But one thing that was integrated into the design of the project, and this is also coming from our experience across working with different customers or users of data, is that sometimes a little bit of extra help, just a conversation, can be really helpful. Just like, don't be afraid. It's a lot of data, but we can do it. There's tips and tricks always. So a component of mentorship has been integrated into the project, in which people that are both, let's say, technically knowledgeable about Planet specificities in terms of data, but also API services, different data streams, because now Planet has a lot of different pieces. So it can be challenging to navigate the Planet system, let's say. Maddie's laughing. Yes, it's true.
Yes. I've experienced this.
She knows. But also a mentorship from a domain expertise side, because maybe people don't realize at Planet we are almost 1,000 people. And I've never seen so many PhDs in one virtual room. It's shocking. And people come from the most varied, very interesting backgrounds. And everyone is so helpful. And so we're also trying to take advantage of that in a way, but also give people the chance to be a bit more practitioners again, if possible, or supporting others in their practice. So oh, cool. I know that's something that's happening. Like I mentioned, the project is really recent. So I think those relationships are only now being started. But that's part of the idea, yes.
Yeah, cool. So I think when Maddie was talking about land surface temperature, that's one of the planetary variables that Planet are creating and making available. Am I right in thinking that planetary variables are also being sort of touted as a data source for this project? And is the idea behind planetary variables to try and make data access easy or easier and timely, so that people who are working on this project but on other projects as well that might benefit from that can sort of make database decisions using the sort of most up-to-date, high-resolution data that there is?
Absolutely. That's a very good. Maybe you should do the promotion of this, Alistair. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, I think, Planet's overall positioning, even in the sector, right? We don't see Planet data as necessarily replacing other data sets, but as complementing. Both from a side of a higher spatial and temporal resolution. So more data, more often, sometimes with a higher resolution, depending on where you compare it with or which constellation you're focusing on. And we also offer more prepared data as well. So analysis ready data, because we also understand that depending on your business, the resources that you have available, both in terms of computing, but also in terms of human resources, you may not want to be doing top of atmosphere corrections. And you may not be interested in having the raw data to test if, I don't know, if the calibration is correct, right? Which is something that I guess maybe the three of us have done, because they're all like nodding.
I'm very, very happy to have left it behind as well.
Exactly. And I think that's kind of the idea as well, of having different levels of processing so that we can not necessarily alienate one user or the other, or maybe not give the let's say, devalue the raw data itself as well by just replacing it for processed data. So we do this with the satellite images, different levels of processing, and then we have the planetary variables, which are kind of a fusion of different data sources. They are really very decision-oriented, like you mentioned. Like, you can just look at them and potentially take some decisions. Depending on what it is, you also have to have some domain knowledge to actually take the right conclusions. And all of these are actually going to be made available within Project Sentinella, within the AOIs of each project. And we're really looking forward to see what is better adjusted to which problem, and also landscape or seascape, right? Because not all data is valuable in all situations. And we really want people to decide what makes sense for you.
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool that, you'll know, so often in Earth observation, people say, oh, well, it's a solution looking for a problem. But actually, in this respect, the problem is sort of known, but then there's the sub-problems that aren't known that are being defined by people who, don't really know about the data. And then this is one of those aspects where actually the data really makes a big difference. So that's really brilliant that
we're hoping
it's working how it should work.
At least they're trying to set the stage that way.
Yeah.
Let's see how it develops, right?
So I'm conscious that we're sort of throwing lots of concepts at the listener, but there's one more that I want to also throw at them because I think it's stunning. So something called Tanager 1, which is a satellite that has recently been launched, I understand, by Planet. I was just wondering whether you could tell the listeners about that program and sort of what, are there any data available, that sort of thing, mm-hmm. if you know.
So yes, I can give you some, it's going to be throwing, like you said, more, and there will be maybe a lot of numbers involved because Tanager is a hyperspectral mission, which means that we not only have the typical RGB near infrared bands, but we have actually 400 bands, and they are... Yeah, it's a lot. Let me see, where can we start? So like you said, it was launched this summer. It's still undergoing commission and verification. So the data is not yet commercially available because we really want to make sure that the product, once it reaches the market, is really of really high quality and can really be uptaken by the users without any issues in terms of... let's say too much noise or bad calibrations, for example. The data itself is, like I said, it has 400 bands. They are 5 nanometer each, let's say. I am not a hyperspectral expert, as you can probably have noticed from my hesitation in the choice of words. But it's in the... So the shortwave infrared spectrum. And in terms of the satellite, how it's operated, it's actually a tasking satellite.
Okay.
And so it's going to work for the people that are familiar with tasking satellites or maybe with a SkySat from Planet specifically, it's going to be operated and managed in a quite similar way. So it can do point collect, in which you choose a particular location to collect images over, or it can do area collect. So it will do repeats until the area is fulfilled. What else? So 400 bands is a lot. Who wants to download 400 bands? I don't know. Maybe Matthew would, because she likes data. But I'm told that the idea is that while the data will always be fully collected and stored, there will be some possibility of applying basic band math to isolate the ones that you want to work with so that you don't download 400 every single time and then have to figure out what to do with that. So there's some practicalities that are going to be included there.
And would that just drop into like your standard processing software? Is that the idea?
Well, I guess I don't think I can say that's the standard processing software, but maybe the standard approach. So it should have the same logic as we just mentioned here. So we're going to have different levels of processing, depending on people wanting the data, like fully raw data or some like further processed data or not. And we're going to serve it, I'm assuming, through our usual platforms. I haven't heard anything otherwise, like in contrary. So I think that would make a lot of sense to really bring even more consistency and cohesion to Planet's offering.
So only twice in my career have I played around with hyperspectral data. I think one was, I can't remember the name of the satellite, which is terrible, but I think it was a NASA satellite that was there as a sort of proof of concept. And the other was aerial data that was collected, again, on a sensor that I don't think ever actually got launched into space. And both times, every time someone opened up the data set, like everyone in the room would gather around their computer and would start talking about, like, can we do this? Can we do that? Can we see that? So I think this is going to be a huge game changer in terms of the types of things that people will start thinking about once they've seen the data. And it's going to be interesting to see the marketing job that is done in order to get people just to understand, really, the potential.
Yeah, I think Planet is kind of used to this kind of having to like, oh, we're going to disrupt again the space sector. So maybe Tanager is going to be another example of this. Let's see. But I feel that we have at least one application that's already very concrete because Tanager is actually sponsored by Carbon Mapper. So The design of part of the design, let's say, was very motivated for methane emissions tracking, but also just emissions in general, but with methane as a very concrete first application. And this has been has been piloted even during the design phase, and I mean we're really positive about it. Everything has been selected for this purpose, and Carbon Mapper is a really good initiative. They're tracking and trying to pinpoint leaks in methane emissions with this notion that, well, methane is such a problematic greenhouse gas, and if you can just avoid some of these, well, actually accidental emissions a lot of the times, it could be extremely impactful. So I think that's going to be the first examples that we're probably going to be seeing from Tanager.
Okay.
And then I'm very curious for whatever wonderful and unexpected applications people are going to find for it.
I was going to say, I expect another couple of blog posts from Maddie about various different interesting things you can do with crops and hyperspectral.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, definitely. Some vegetation characteristic and species applications for hyperspectral data, certainly.
Yeah, that'd be very cool.
Yeah, we're very excited about biodiversity applications, which is something that hasn't been so explored in general by the space sector. So
that's excellent. So I'm going to have to wrap it up there, unfortunately, because it is really fascinating. I have a whole raft of links for various different things that we've talked about. I'll make sure that those are in the show notes. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming on the podcast. It's been, like I say, it's been fascinating conversation.
Thank you, Alistair, and I look forward for the next times.
Indeed.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.